You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
All right, well, I think we'll go ahead and get started, and if anybody's sorry for the room switch up on us that happened midweek, but thank y'all for being here, making your way down here, and thank you for joining us for the last class on biblical barrenness. My husband Will and I moved to Birmingham last July, and I remember our first Sunday at the Advent approaching the left side of the altar for communion and kneeling before this stained glass painting, which you may have noticed before. I've actually used the cropped image of this painting of Eve weeping over the body of the child for the last two classes because I remember such an immediate sense of recognition when I looked up at the woman weeping over the lost child. The striking thing about this painting to me is that Eve is not weeping over her own lost son, Abel, who was murdered by his brother as a young man, but over a baby. There are several instances in the Bible of women weeping over her lost children. There's a refrain of one of our own barren women, Rachel, weeping over her lost children in Jeremiah, which Matthew actually echoes in mourning over Herod's slaughter of the innocents. Rachel's grief over her own barrenness and her subsequent death in childbirth make her a natural personification of this national mourning. Daughter Zion in Lamentations weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks. Her children have gone away. But we know from the placement of this painting as part of the nativity window that here Eve is weeping over the Christ child. This painting collapses all of these narratives together. The loss of Eden, the death of Abel, the grief of barrenness, the weeping of Rachel and daughter Zion, the birth of Jesus, and also in the outstretched arms of the infant, the death of Jesus, and the weeping of his own mother, Mary. This window, to me, powerfully portrays a particular kind of grief and despair, that of a mother mourning a lost child. But everywhere through the broader scene, when we open it up, there are glimpses of hope. The angel standing guard, holding the lily flower. Satan turning away in fear. The serpent, whose head will be crushed. And finally, beyond the outstretched body of the child, we have the sun rising, the rays pouring out over the sea and sky. This window is a beautiful picture of hope, but after my own years of grief and pregnancy loss, I found its poignancy and vivid depiction of sorrow to be its own kind of comfort. I saw in the weeping Eve myself, and in the solemn Christ child, my own lost children. I think, after all, this is what these scriptural stories have given me. The stories we've covered of Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, the wife of Manoah, Hannah, the woman of Shunem. I've recognized my pain in their pain, recognized the graceful actions of God in their lives as the same grace that has filled the empty pockets of my life. We may be separated from these women by thousands of years and a wide cultural gulf, but I still see myself in them. I see the details of my own story mirrored in theirs. In the last two classes, we've covered the stories of the six barren women in the Hebrew scriptures, the three matriarchs whose barrenness God used as the site of the creation of the nation of Israel, and three women in Israel's history whose barrenness God used to both begin and illustrate his plan of deliverance for Israel. We've seen in the wombs of these women the pattern of God's salvation, life from deadness. And with the final narrative, the woman of Shunem, we saw the healing not only of her womb, but the bodily resurrection of her boy after his death in adolescence. When we look at the connections and the overlaps in each narrative, note, for instance, that Samson has his power taken away while on Delilah's lap, which leads to his death, in the same way that the woman of Shunem's son dies on his mother's lap. We see the intricate interplay between these stories, the ways in which they repeat and reinterpret each other, the long, long years of waiting for the matriarchs, 25 years for Sarah, 20 for Rebecca, and 14 for Rachel. The competition with other more fertile wives, the pain of that competition. How many of these women's first recorded words are about their childlessness? The way that God remembers them, this Hebrew zakar, and their sons, which is the verb for the way God springs into salvific action. Several of these children are set apart, consecrated to God according to the Nazarite vow of number 6, which includes no wine or strong drink or hair cutting. We see a strange repetition of flour cakes in these narratives. Both Manoah and Abraham present these to their angelic visitors, and Hannah brings one with her to the temple when she returns to present Samuel. More on that later. We see repetitive phrases. Both Manoah and Isaac entreat the Lord. And there's another repetition in the stories of Sarah, the wife of Manoah, and Hannah. The child grew and was weaned. The young man grew and the Lord blessed him. The boy grew in the presence of the Lord, along with the pattern of, and she conceived and bore a son, which you'll note the wife of Manoah's phrase, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, we'll hear again. And the opening, too, of the wife of Manoah and Hannah's story, there was a certain man. There are a few specific details that tie our final barren woman of the Old Testament, the woman of Shunem, back to our first, Sarah. Both women are given a due date. Both women stand in the threshold of a tent and of a door. Both, when they hear the annunciation of their promised son, both their husbands are noted to be of advanced years. And both are told that they will be delivered of a son at an appointed time. The Hebrew word for this, moed, is defined as a divinely set time, divinely set moment in history. In many ways, the woman of Shunem's story both retells and escalates Sarah's story. They both express doubt and disbelief when they hear the promise of a son. And though Isaac is almost killed on Mount Moriah, the woman of Shunem's son actually dies. It is only her belief in the power of God's word through the prophet Elisha that allows her to call on that power, to ride to Mount Carmel on a donkey, to bring Elisha back with her to resurrect her boy. We learn in her story about the pattern of faith as a posture of dependence rather than independence. And Hebrews 11 summarizes all of this for us very tidily, where each of these families is recorded as ones who saw, even in the midst of their darkness, the evidence of things unseen. Abraham and Sarah, as good as dead. Isaac, Jacob, son of the barren Rebekah. Joseph, son of the barren Rachel. Samson, son of the barren wife of Manoah. Samuel, son of the barren Hannah. And finally, women who received back their dead by resurrection, which includes the woman of Shunem. And yet Hebrews says all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised. Something better was coming. Barrenness, as we saw from Walter Brueggemann in the last class, is the penultimate humiliation. The healing of a womb, the birth of a promised child, all of this is earthly comfort, comfort for a particular time of life, but it is penultimate comfort. Death still waits to claim all of these women and their children. The world's pain and sorrow and brokenness still threaten, still surround and besiege the families of God. Miscarriage and infertility are still an intimate reality. We all still weep as Eve does. So we have to ask ourselves, is the comfort found in these stories of these miraculous healings really comfort? If you've been in the last two classes, you know I've been dropping all too obvious hints that each of these stories points to a new kind of hope. A hope that fulfills the patterns we've seen, but that also turns these motifs on their head. This is a hope that does last. So we turn to the first two chapters of Luke. The final barren woman in the Bible is perhaps as well known as the first. The Gospel of Luke begins not with the story of Jesus' birth, as Matthew does, nor with the ministry of John the Baptist, as Mark and John do, but with a phrase we've seen before. There was a certain man. This time, that man is a priest, Zechariah, of the division of Abia. His wife, from the daughters of Aaron, is named Elizabeth. They were righteous, walking blamelessly in the commandments and statutes of the Lord, but they had no child. Elizabeth was barren, and both were advanced in years. Think just for a second about the assurance that Luke offers here. They were righteous, walking blamelessly. We can't always say that about the stories of our other barren families, but here Luke does. There's no special sin or mistake or curse that Elizabeth and Zechariah have somehow called down on themselves to cause this barrenness. It is, as we know well, just the way of our fallen, broken world that a family so upright and blameless could still be filled with such longing and emptiness. If you've experienced barrenness yourself, you know that there's nothing that you have done or didn't do to cause it, to prevent it, or conversely, to fix it. Let Scripture assure you of that. Zechariah is a priest in the division of Abia. David established 24 divisions of priests to serve in the temple, and 1 Chronicles tells us that the division of Abia is the eighth. Each division served in the temple for a week at a time, twice a year, where they were responsible for the sacrificial offerings, maintaining the sacred space, and many other priestly duties. Luke also notes that Elizabeth was from the daughters of Aaron, Moses' brother and the first high priest. So not only are Zechariah and Elizabeth righteous and blameless in their own lives, but their lineage is the priesthood twice over. But they have no child to pass this privileged lineage onto. Luke takes time to set the scene of the Annunciation that is to come. Zechariah is chosen by lot to burn incense in the temple. The hour of incense is a daily moed in the Hebrew, one of those divinely appointed moments, such as the due dates of Sarah and the woman of Shunem. And it was also a great honor for the priest to burn the incense. A priest might be chosen only once in a lifetime to do this. You can see from the diagram of the temple here where the priest would be at the altar of incense, just before, right on the threshold of the veil between the Holy of Holies. Near the altar of incense was also the bread of presence, the showbread, which was a special offering of 12 flour cakes. Remember the flour cake offerings in the stories of Abraham, Manoah, and Hannah. Luke also notes that at this divinely appointed hour of incense, the whole multitude of the people were praying outside. So they would be praying in places like the Israelites' courtyard or the women's courtyard, while Zechariah would be all the way in here at that deep inside the temple. As he's lighting the incense, the white smoke billowing before the temple curtain, the prayers of the Israelites are ascending to heaven. Both Psalm 141 and Revelation reflect this imagery. Let my prayer be set before thee as incense. And the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. So in this moment of praise and prayer and sacrifice, this divinely appointed time of ritual, the angel Gabriel appears at the right hand of the altar. Gabriel has been sent to earth to answer both the corporate prayers of the Israelite nation as they are praying outside the temple. We'll see this when he arrives in Galilee several months later. But he is also here in this moment, at this hour, to answer the very personal, inner, unspoken prayer of this old priest. Gabriel's annunciation to Zechariah follows many of the patterns that we've seen already. Fear not, Zechariah, the angel says, for your prayer has been heard. Fear not, Abraham, the word of the Lord said. He must not drink wine or strong drink, Gabriel tells Zechariah, just as the angel told the wife of Manoah, claiming both John and Samson as Nazarites, as we also saw with Joseph and Samuel. He will make ready for the Lord a people prepared, Gabriel says, just as the angel of the Lord told the wife of Manoah that Samson would begin to deliver Israel. But how shall I know, Abraham asks the Lord, and Zechariah echoes, how shall I know this? For I am an old man, and my wife is advanced in years. Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old, Abraham asked. Shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? Disbelief, doubt, shame. We've seen it in the other stories, and we see it with Zechariah. How can such a miracle be possible? Gabriel's answer to Zechariah is admittedly a strange one, not one we've seen before. Behold, you will be silent and unable to speak until the day that these things take place, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their appointed time. The Greek here, kairos, aligns with the Hebrew moed for this divinely appointed time. Everything about Zechariah here typifies the traditional Jewish priest, faithful, upright, righteous. His story typifies the traditional Jewish narrative, the promised son, the old barren couple. But Gabriel has just stopped Zechariah's tongue, rendering him silent. And this will not be the silence of a few days or weeks. This is a silence that will last until the day that these things take place, the day his son is born. 9 months, 40 weeks. We talked in the last class about the number 40. Strong's notes that 40 marks eras of testing and judgment. Think 40 days of flood, 40 days Moses spends on Sinai, 40 years in the desert, 40 days that Goliath taunts Israel, 40 years Israel's under the Philistines before Samson. But that 40 also marks transitional moments in redemptive history that bring an old order to an end and usher in a new beginning. Zechariah will be silent for 40 weeks, his stricture only broken by the birth of the boy who will be the herald of a new order, a new beginning, a new hope. So Zechariah's time in the temple comes to an end, and he returns home. And we finally hear the first words of his wife, Elizabeth. Thus the Lord has done for me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach among people. Her words repeat those of two other barren women, Hannah, who asked the Lord to look on her affliction, and Rachel, who said that God has taken away her reproach. We spoke about how the reproach that Rachel fears is both a societal and marital reproach that one would expect a barren woman to fear in the ancient world, but that also, based on the words used in Genesis, Rachel would have feared a covenantal reproach, that for whatever reason, she had been removed from God's promises. We can see why Elizabeth might feel similarly, righteous and blameless, and yet still no child. Why her? Interestingly, the Greek word that Luke uses for her for reproach here, onedos, is used only here and nowhere else in the New Testament. Similarly, when Elizabeth echoes Hannah saying that the Lord has looked on her, the Greek verb epaidon is used here and only one other time in Acts. So Luke is using specific Greek words not common to the New Testament to align Elizabeth's speech with the Old Testament vocabulary of Rachel and Hannah. everything we've seen demonstrates that Luke is painting this couple as the last in a long line of barren couples whose pain and longing are met with a miraculous promise from the Lord. But Luke is also preparing for something new. We're told that Elizabeth hides herself away for 5 months after she conceives. Paired with Zechariah's muteness, we can imagine these 20 weeks in their home as a time of quietness, of anticipation, of waiting. Fred Craddock notes in his commentary, we're left in a mood of expectation. And in our Old Testament narratives, almost as soon as the words of Annunciation are spoken, our barren women conceive and their sons are born. And sometimes this happens all in the span of one verse. So why do we suddenly have this pause, this silence, this waiting? The next verse is the pivot point. In the 6th month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth to a virgin betrothed to a man. Gabriel returns to earth, this time not to an elderly barren woman, for whom biology makes it impossible to have a child, but to a young unmarried virgin, for whom biology makes it impossible to have a child. And yet, Gabriel announces, like her cousin Elizabeth, she will. There is many similarities to our Old Testament stories in Mary's Annunciation scene as there are with Zechariah. Both hear the same words as Abraham, do not be afraid. Gabriel's Annunciation echoes the angel of the Lord to the wife of Manoah in Judges 13, thou shalt conceive and bear a son. This time, instead of beginning to deliver Israel as Samson did, this Jesus will be called the Son of the Most High, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end. The Annunciation of Jesus' birth is the Annunciation of the completion of Israel's deliverance. The same Israel that was created out of barrenness in the matriarchs, the same Israel whose deliverance began in the barrenness of the wife of Manoah, Hannah, and now Elizabeth. But now the salvation of Israel will be completed through a womb that is even more impossible. For here, there's no husband. So like Sarah, Rachel, Hannah, and Elizabeth before her, Mary's first recorded words about her status are as childless. Though we should note that her words are not a complaint, a petition, or a grateful response. Instead, she simply asks a question. How will this be, since I am a virgin? Back in Genesis, when Sarah heard the Lord announce her pregnancy, she laughed. And God asked Abraham and her, is anything too hard for the Lord? Here, in Gabriel's response to Mary, we have our answer. For nothing will be impossible with God. Mary's pregnancy fulfills the open-ended question from Genesis. The question that we have seen God work in time and again, 7 times over. Is there anything too wonderful for the Lord? Brueggemann says that when we're ready to answer, as Gabriel does, that nothing is impossible with God, we're ready to accept God's freedom, that the self and the world are fully entrusted to God and to no other. We let the initiative for our lives flow from our hands. Mary's response, behold, I am the handmaid of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word. Mary receives the words of Gabriel not with the closed fist, but with the open palm. Luke is intentional with the narrative frame of the first few chapters of his gospel. It's impossible to tell the story of John's birth without telling the story of Jesus. So we begin with the Annunciation and conception of John, then move to the Annunciation and conception of Jesus. Next comes the visitation. After Gabriel leaves, Mary hurries to the hill country to greet Elizabeth, now in the 6th month of her pregnancy. The visitation is the beautiful moment when John leaps in his mother's womb and Elizabeth recognizes the blessedness of Mary and the fruit of her womb. Here we have 2 reversals from our previous narratives. The first is the allusion to the wrestling of Jacob and Esau in Rebekah's womb. Craddock notes that John's leap in Elizabeth's womb echoes the message that the elder shall serve the younger, but here there's joy, rather than threats of fratricide. The second redemptive reversal is that of the co-wife competition. Sarah and Hagar, Rachel and Leah, Hannah and Peninnah. Rather than wrestling with each other for primacy in a family, these two cousins rejoice together. As Jan Wojcik notes, John and Jesus are brothers in a kingdom of brotherhood to be founded by Jesus and announced by John. Mary also in this scene sings her Magnificat, which is a reworking of Hannah's song after the birth of Samuel. You can see the similarities in the opening lines and the repetitions of themes, the reversals of the mighty and the poor, those who hunger and those who are rich. Hannah's song ends looking forward, a note of prophecy. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. While Mary's ends looking backwards in remembrance of his mercy and the covenant with Abraham. So Mary's pregnancy is something new and something old. As Craddock says, because hope is always joined to memory, and the new is God's keeping of an old promise. So now we get the scene of John's birth, where Elizabeth's neighbors and relatives rejoice with her and come on the eighth day to circumcise the child and to hear his name. They want to call him Zechariah, but Elizabeth insists on John. They make signs to Zechariah. Surely he will think differently. Instead, Zechariah writes, "His name is John," on a tablet, following Gabriel's instruction. And it is at this moment that his mouth is opened, and his tongue is loosed, and he speaks. But it's not just any speech. He sings a song that parallels both Hannah's and Mary's. He begins his song with the fulfillment of the ending of Hannah's. The horn that will be exalted in hers has been raised up now as a horn of salvation for us. Sorry, I've lost my place. Ooh, sorry. There we go. Zechariah also echoes the remembrance language of Mary, calling to mind the Hebrew Zakar that we've seen so many times when God remembered Rachel, Samson, Hannah. And this salvific remembrance action, which began with Noah and Abraham, continues through the barrenness narratives and finally finds its fulfillment in the fruit of Mary's womb. Zechariah's song ends, and Luke gives us one more note on the narrative of John's birth. And the child grew and became strong in spirit. We saw this formulation with Isaac. The child grew and was weaned. Samson, the young man grew and the Lord blessed him. And Samuel, the boy Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. Luke will actually repeat this formula twice for Jesus after his two childhood scenes in the temple. And the child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom. So as we follow these intricate parallels in the stories of John and Jesus, Wojcik notes that Luke is deliberately broadening the scope of what is considered family by the juxtaposition of these two stories. When John is born, Elizabeth's neighbors and family rejoice with her. When Jesus is born, strange shepherds and angels rejoice. Zechariah's song speaks of the mercy and covenant of God to the people of Israel. When Jesus is brought to the temple at 6 weeks old, Simeon's song sings of him being a light to lighten the Gentiles, as well as the glory of Israel. When John's ministry is introduced, he is the son of Zechariah, emphasizing his priestly lineage, while Jesus' genealogy in Luke goes all the way back beyond Abraham, all the way back to Adam, beyond the creation of Israel to a global lineage. Preaching in the wilderness, John's ministry comes to an end with his imprisonment. Jesus' ministry begins after his own testing in the wilderness. In Jesus' baptism, the elder brother yields to the younger. And Wojcik writes, John, who typifies the traditional Jewish prophet and hero, yields to a new type, one whose family is larger than the immediate one. Thus, if we add Elizabeth to the bottom of our chart, and I know this is tiny, but basically just the gist is she fills in every column, every cell, basically. And if we add Mary as the eighth woman, we see that all of these patterns are either fulfilled or reversed by the birth and the work of Jesus. As we said at the beginning of our classes, it's no accident that there are seven barren women in the Bible. Seven is the Hebrew number of completion, the final day of creation. But with Mary's impossible pregnancy, the total number of women who bear heroic sons in this pattern becomes eight, the number of superabundance, the eighth day of the week, the day of the new creation. The old barren woman has become the young virgin, and the son has become the deliverer not just of Israel, but of the world. We see in Jesus' birth the fulfillment of the fourth chapter of Isaiah. On that day, seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, "Only let us be called by your name, take away our reproach." On that day, Isaiah says, "The branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious." The Bible-long narrative of barrenness finds its climax in the virgin birth. Seven women have had their reproach taken away, and the branch of the Lord, Jesus, is beautiful and glorious. But as we know from the stories of our other barren women, the miraculous birth is not the end. There is the death to come. And it's here in this death that two important turns occur. First, this strange Nazarite vow that has entwined itself in our stories since Genesis, when Joseph was first proclaimed Nazir, set apart from his brothers. And then Samson, Samuel, and John all take part in the Nazarite prohibitions. The Nazarite vow is for one set apart, made holy, consecrated before the Lord. In the Gospel of John, when Jesus prays to his Father before turning his face from the Garden of Gethsemane towards the cross, he prays these words, "And for their sake I consecrate myself, that they may also be sanctified in truth." The epistle writers echo this language of being set apart and sanctified over and over again. There's so many more verses I could have put on this slide. Jesus is the perfect fulfillment of the Nazarite vow, the only one who could completely consecrate himself and set himself apart to God. And then he gives that consecration to us, to those who believe in him. He makes us a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. He shares his holiness with us, undeserving as we are. Which brings us finally to the cross. At the opening of the Bible in the first chapters of Genesis, we learn that God made us for each other. "It is not good that the man should be alone," he said. God gives us to each other in marriage, in motherhood and fatherhood and sisterhood and brotherhood, but at the foot of the cross, God forms a new family. And this family is the fulfillment of the broadening scope that we saw with Jesus' annunciation and birth, the family beyond the Israelite one, beyond the immediate. "Woman," Jesus tells Mary, "behold thy son." But he's not speaking of himself. He's not speaking of the body she carried within her womb, the boy she'd nursed in infancy, reared in adolescence, and followed to the chasm of death. Instead, he's speaking of the man beside her. A man whom she'd never carried as a baby, never comforted as a child. A man she'd come to know only within the last 3 years. "But it is this man," Jesus says, "who is now her son. Behold thy mother," he says to John. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, saith, "I thirst." When Jesus, therefore, had received the vinegar, he said, "It is finished," and he bowed his head and gave up the ghost. The family of God is forged at the foot of the cross, and it is a family bigger and more beautiful than any of us could conceive of on our own. It's a family beyond DNA and genetic codes and blood types. It's a family consecrated to God, set apart as holy, and born from one blood and one body. Born from a dead and barren tomb that became the final womb, the physical place from which everlasting resurrection life was born. The stories of Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel and Hannah and the wife of Manoah and the woman of Shunem and Elizabeth give us hope for today, that barrenness can be healed, that wombs can be opened, that children can be born. But it is Mary's son who gives us hope for tomorrow, who shows us that we are all, already and forever, members in corporate in the mystical body, a blessed company of all faithful people. That our sons and daughters and mothers and fathers are already here in this room, in this church. Out on the playground, a boy needs someone to throw him a baseball. Down the street, a man needs an extra cup of coffee and someone to talk to. Across the hall, a young mom needs someone to hold her baby so she can pick up all the goldfish that just fell on the floor. We are a family born in blood and bound by faith. And whether we hold our own babies or whether we're held by others, it is God's arms, outstretched, flung wide, that are wrapped so lovingly, so gently around us all. So thank you so much.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.